Welcome to the latest episode in the Enterprise Times podcast series. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Eric Newcomer, who's the CTO at WSO2, and Ricardo Dinez, who's the general manager at WSO2. We're going to be talking about the challenges of digital transformation, and particularly how do we make sure that the APIs we use are fit for service. Eric, Ricardo, hello.
Ian, hello. Very glad to be here. As you said, I'm CTO at WSO2, coming up on a year end of this month. Before that, about 8 years at Citibank, chief architect for treasury and trade, and involved in security architecture as well. There, I was working a lot on cloud adoption, which is one of the things I'm helping WSO2 with as we're pivoting from our traditional open source product line to our cloud-based product line coming out early next year.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me here. I am Ricardo Diniz. I am general manager for UK and Southern Europe. I'm very glad to be here.
We've seen over the last 18 months, 2 years, a significant acceleration of people's plans for digital transformation. In reality, it's a continuous transformation, not a one-off, which I think is a mistake that we're seeing from a lot of people. With those plans come an awful lot of challenges. What are you seeing when you look around your customer base and the industry in terms of people moving to cloud and starting that whole digitization process?
That's right. If anything, the pandemic has accelerated this, but it's a trend that's here to stay. Digital transformation companies are basing their plans on customer expectations that have been set now by the digital pioneers. We're talking about Netflix, Uber, Amazon, all of these companies that really specialize in creating a very intuitive, easy-to-use, highly interactive website or mobile app. People are just used to working that way now. And then when they're going into a bank, as we found at Citigroup, and having to do something manually, they're not sure how to do it anymore. They're not sure what that means. Why isn't it on my phone? Why is it not on my website? And I think this is going across the world through governments that are engaged in their digitization programs. Of course, the pandemic accelerates this, but as you said, Ian, it's a trend that's here to stay.
You mentioned those digital pioneers. One of the things they've done is created this frictionless environment. If we think about our move to web, we've ended up with a very different environment when you're on your PC or your laptop compared to on your phone or other devices. Frictionless has to make life easier for customers. So why is frictionless difficult for a lot of organizations to deliver?
Just take the examples we just mentioned about banks and government. Traditionally, for a bank, it's a little bit of an oversimplification these days, but traditionally the model is you go to the bank, you talk with a teller, you present some kind of ID, they work on the system that was designed to operate that bank, and you, as the bank's customer, are more or less expected to adapt to how they do business. They want to see your ID, they want to log into their banking system, they want to get the information from you that feeds that system. You're interacting with the computer through the intermediary of the bank teller in this case, and you're having to supply the information the bank teller needs to interact with that system. Same with the government. I'm sure we're all familiar with going into motor vehicles, or going to benefits office, or going to pay taxes, or whatever it is. You ask to present a government ID. And the government employees work on their systems that are designed to support the government function. It's not designed to interact with you, the citizen. It's designed to interact with the government employee. They, therefore, are asking you for the information they need to interact with their systems. Now, if you think about this as a mobile phone interaction, you cannot present to a government employee your government ID or to a bank teller your bank ID or your ATM card or whatever it is they want to use. You're expecting this system to adapt to you. Digital pioneers applications makes it easy. Uber makes it easy to get a ride. Netflix makes it very easy to stream a program, to sign up for things, to pay for things. Now, the shoe's on the other foot. Customers are expecting these applications to adapt to how they want to do things, as opposed to when you go into the office, you are expected to adapt to the way the employees want to do it. One more point about this, the employees are basically a captive audience, whether it's a bank or government. They are trained to use these systems. Companies and governments create for how they want to do things. And the employees, because they're employees, they're having to be trained on it. You cannot train a millennial or somebody who's on a web browser interacting with the bank how to use that app. You don't have the luxury of saying, All right, before you can sit down and meet customers or meet citizens, you have to take 30-day training on this IT system. You have to have it usable right away, right out of the box.
But we are seeing some smarter systems coming along. Ricardo, when we were talking recently, you mentioned how you're seeing city systems starting to change, starting to deliver to those mobile devices in the way that the end user wants it.
Yes, of course. I chose some use case that digital transformation was driven by customer needs. For example, Transport for London here in the UK, they have a solid plan to improve their services and make commuting safer and better for its citizens. We are part of one of their projects called London Works. London Works has the registry of all the road works and street-related events to improve coordination of road maintenance. This has helped TfL to deliver a better customer and citizens' experience to its citizens.
I find that road maintenance one very interesting because if I go back 30 plus years, we had a UK government that said that councils had to do a better job when a road was opened by a utility company. They had to ask all the other utility companies if they needed access, because once it was closed, you couldn't open it again for another 6 months. Yet here we are, 30, 35 years on from that, and we're still having this discussion about how do we make that better?
Yes, exactly. And nowadays, for example, what we are doing is integrating all those stakeholders that you just mentioned. We know that you need to plan. It's a different elements that we need to coordinate to make that particular thing possible. So now we are in that particular journey.
If we think about cities that have been doing a lot of things, in Spain, we hear a lot about what Barcelona has done, but it's not the only city in Spain that's doing an awful lot to deliver new services to customers through the use of APIs. There's a lot going on in Madrid. What can you tell us about that?
Basically, COVID has accelerated the digital adoption. So Madrid and also Andalusia government, they adopt WSO2 in order to help them to come up with a platform to deliver services to their citizens. Nowadays, 30% of the citizens in Spain can use platform in order to generate new services. If they need to issue a certificate, if they need to issue a passport, they can do it through a platform. During the lockdown, we know that all the departments in the government was shut, and then the citizens were not be able to do anything in person. Now they have that particular platform, which is a very nice use case.
Do you have any idea of how much money they've saved or how many services they've been able to add in the last 18 months?
We do not have the full analysis, but what we heard about is they streamlined their whole process by 30%. They do not have to do the checks by paper, and they have stream processes in their platform in order to do it much more faster.
If we look back at the traditional way we've built websites or we've built customer-facing systems, we've ended up with 4 or 5 different systems trying to deliver the same information to customers. Eric, when you mentioned people like Netflix and Uber, they've taken a very different approach with APIs. What is it that they've managed to get right that we need to start doing from every company's perspective?
This is where we come in. You need a back end as a service or a back end support for these great GUIs that will power them and allow them to be flexible, allow them to be intuitive, and allow the data to be there when you need it. And as you said, Ian, sometimes the companies who are putting these web pages out are just thinking about, for example, externalizing their current systems that are designed for the employees. Therefore, you may end up with 4 or 5 different ways, 4 or 5 different applications, just exposed out to the web without a thought about how they can be integrated. The digital pioneers think about this right from the beginning. They set up that back-end set of APIs knowing they want to power these great graphical user interfaces that are flexible and intuitive to use. These things have to go hand in hand. You cannot just take an old application that was designed for employee use and put it out on the web and expect that somebody's going to be trained on it and know how to use it. They have to be done together. You can't do one without the other.
But how do they make that effective? If we look at a lot of the first, second, even third generation of APIs out there, these were designed for internal developers to build internal systems. What companies did was they tried to clean them up, tidy them up, and then make them available to people outside the company. That came with security issues, scalability issues, but more importantly, it came with massive usability issues.
Absolutely. This is something we encountered at Citi. Let's say we had a system that took a series of payment instructions to be executed by the bank, and we had a way to send the file to us based on our internal systems, and customers had to adapt to that. And these might be institutions. I was in the institutional bank at the time, and they would invest in some infrastructure on their end to conform to our infrastructure on our end and send across sort of B2B type of messages. Now, when you move to APIs, you're getting into the world of standards, RESTful standards, web standards, and predictable behavior that everybody wants to see. They don't want to create bespoke custom adaptations for B2B. They just want to get that good old RESTful HTTP-based API in a standard format. The struggle is changing the mindset from I'm going to create a custom bespoke integration with my partners to I'm going to publish a standard that everybody can understand and immediately and intuitively use. So there's a thought process that has to change when you move from the proprietary world of closed systems or closely integrated systems out to the World Wide Web where everything has to follow the same standard. That's the minimum. Beyond that, you have to take the next step of if you're going to a customer-facing app, such as a retail bank or a government office, now you have to put yourselves in the shoes of the customer or the citizen to make sure you have the right data in the right place at the right time to make it useful and usable as they expect.
If I think about the TfL app you were mentioning just now, Ricardo, one of the challenges they've got is they're not just dealing with their own people. There are dozens of different telcos in London, dozens of different utility companies in London, all of whom want access to that road. At the same time, they've got to deal with traffic management applications. They've got to inform the police. They've also got to get buy-in from local councils who have to publish when the roads are going to be closed or opened or anything else. How have they handled that with APIs?
They are not in that particular momentum of the APIs yet. So it's a journey, I would say. What they are doing just right now is planning and helping the database that they have. What they are doing with that particular London Works project is to make sure that all the data from different stakeholders are available. The next step should be to publish those data in different platforms.
One of the challenges that we see with APIs is companies, when they do get it right and they go API first, they understand what it is they want to do. They have an expectation of the size of customer base. But as we all know, you get something very right in this industry and suddenly you have to scale by many, many factors because if you've got it right, everybody wants to utilize it. How hard is it to build scalability into your APIs?
This is a very big challenge, Ian. You're absolutely right. And this is a bit of the story of the web when websites first came out, such as eBay and Foursquare, Amazon, Twitter. They came out with very simple application server-based applications. And pretty soon, once they started to gain adoption, some of these companies would get spikes overnight, huge interest in very popular toys, or plenty of ticket sites would crash under unexpected load. So they would have to redesign, re-engineer, put in more hardware and more software, and figure out new load balancing algorithms, caching techniques, and faster data stores, all of these kinds of things. This is ultimately what led to the invention of cloud-native computing as a way to help solve scalability issues in general. Now, pretty much all websites are on this kind of infrastructure. If you look at data centers, you can find it on the web. You can get web tours of Twitter and Facebook and Amazon and Google. Racks and racks and racks of PC-grade hardware. The basic capability is you can just add on whatever you need to add on, and the system keeps going. You can add capacity now dynamically. This is why we encourage people, customers, and governments who are looking to provide their great digital experiences to customers to move to the cloud, to move to cloud-native applications and the cloud-native infrastructure to get these capabilities that they've come to expect from the digital pioneers who are already moved there. The reliability, the scale, the always-on capability, the resiliency, so it's always there. These are things that have been made available now in the cloud. We are adapting our technologies. I mentioned earlier, part of the things I'm working on is to get our APIs, our services, our integrations onto cloud-native infrastructure so that the scale can be very easily solved for the companies who are looking to move there. So we're providing that bit of help from A to B for customers interested in this journey.
But for those customers, when they first come to cloud, they've had a very varied journey. Some have simply put their running systems into virtual machines, uploaded it to cloud. Some have ported into cloud. Some have gone full cloud native right from the start of that game. The same is true of their APIs. Their APIs may well have been written with an assumption that we have a degree of on-premise equipment. What becomes the core element they need to start looking at to create a cloud-first, API-first environment?
It's still going to be a mixed bag for foreseeable future for many people. They'll need to think about scalability on-prem, which we have available in our on-prem products. But when we think about APIs being designed for the cloud, you want to be able to build them and engineer them for the cloud. And there are certain techniques around microservices-based architectures, service meshes, highly available data stores, and a plethora of cloud-native services that the public cloud providers offer to support this kind of scalability. You want to start thinking about re-engineering your application to take advantage of those things, create microservices, decompose your monolith to microservices, and put the APIs on microservices to help with the scalability, the flexibility, the reliability that those things can bring. Absent that, you want to think about creating new functionality. In many cases, digital transformation projects are going to require a new capability, a new service, another way of accessing data than you had thought of before. In the case we were talking about earlier, you go into an office, provide your ID, you're in the government's mercy in terms of what they need to access the system. But if you're on the mobile web, you're going to need additional ways of getting to that information, maybe name and address, maybe phone number, another key to look up and access that data, make it very easy. So you're going to build some new functionality that helps create this great service for your customers and the citizens. There, you want to have a cloud-native development toolkit. You want low-code, no-code templates, cloud-native engineering-based integrations, a language and syntax that abstracts this and provides the programming model that you need, and make it very easy to do the deployment at the same time. We're looking at all these things that you need to help you get there.
Ricardo, with your work that you're doing with customers, how many of them are actually starting out today as cloud-native API first, and how many are still caught in that we might have some on-prem, we might have some older systems, and instead of committing fully, they're still trying to hold on to the past?
It depends on many factors. One of the factors are their industries. What we have seen is many of the public sector is still on a hybrid model. They started their journey. And to be honest, we can help them wherever they are on that particular journey. What we also have seen is the COVID situation has accelerated their digital adoption. I cannot disclose the customer, but one of the biggest retail company in Europe uses us, and we help them in order to transform all their business model. Because from one day to another, they need to shut all their high street stores and transform those stores into warehousing. And then the customer, they started with private cloud to scale, and they are looking forward to going into that particular journey to start with 100% on the cloud.
How much is that a challenge for them in terms of basic architecture? Do they have the right architects to begin to design these APIs? Do they have the right understanding of cloud to be able to say, we can commit completely into doing this? Or is there still a skills gap we need to deal with?
It's a skills gap and also understanding about how to deal with that particular new technology. This is what I see in the terms of the sales side.
Absolutely. We see a worldwide developer shortage in general, and for cloud skills, it's even more acute. You look at somebody who has a recent example of moving fully to the cloud from a traditional business, that's Capital One. They announced it earlier this year. They'd fully closed their data centers. I want to make it clear they're not a customer of ours, but I think they're a very interesting case study because it took them 4 years of concerted effort and considerable investment to get from on-prem to the cloud. And we think today, 4 years later, it shouldn't take so long. It shouldn't be so hard. There's got to be help for those developers in low-code, no-code abstractions, even in a language we're working on called Ballerina that helps improve the ability to intuitively use and implement this new programming model that's part of how you get to the cloud. It's a lot of efforts to adapt Java to this. We've done a high-level syntax for this programming model, it makes it easy to abstract into low code, no code, and provide the help for those developers, and especially in the cloud, which is where our next generation products are coming out next year. They'll have that intuitive, easy to use interface to create these new apps, create these new APIs, and deploy them transparently out onto Kubernetes to get the scale and resiliency and always on capability that they need. We very much see that as a gap that needs to be filled because of that continued shortage.
One part of the conversation we've been having for seemingly ever is security. Security is always part of that conversation where everybody sort of shuffles their feet and looks at their fingers and stares at the ceiling, because no matter how much we say build it in from the start, people don't. But APIs become quite critical to get that security in, because there's a danger of abuse if we're not good.
Well, it's a very interesting point, Ian. I was reading an article the other day, in fact, that talked about how security perimeters are not secure anymore. Companies have invested a lot in putting up web application firewalls and secure gateways, and yet the hackers are getting through. And ID management for APIs becomes the next line of defense. When you need to have a strong identity for the API, strong authorization, strong authentication just to get in, to prevent people from getting in. And then once they are in, the ability to track those IDs and monitor when something goes wrong. This is really something you have to build in from the beginning. If you put an API out there, we had this happen a few times at Citi. I was working in the security team for a while, as I mentioned, and we would find out somebody had put an API out there because it was under attack. We'd get these phone calls and messages. Hey, what's going on? Why didn't you guys put the security defense in there? We said, we didn't even know the API has gone out there, because the programming team, the developers, really didn't want to have to bother with it. They thought this was going to slow them down. They got to get into production, support the needs of the business, get the money coming in. But if you don't put it in there from the beginning and you have an incident, that's going to affect your business as well. So absolutely has to be put in and thought of to prevent those kinds of things.
Are you seeing people being smarter when they go API first? Because obviously, if they've started with something built internally, security will never have been part of that conversation, because they're building this for their own consumption. Therefore, there will be an assumption that they know what they're going to do with it. Once they go to API first, that's then going to be publicly available very quickly, are they changing that mindset?
That's exactly the trouble. In some cases, they're not. They're still imagining the API as if it were working inside the firewall internally to the company. They're not thinking about the additional consequence of exposing it out to the internet and making it part of the attack surface of a company. What we're trying to do in this area is to provide the code for these developers as libraries and SDKs that can be incorporated in their IDEs as they're working. They don't have to think about it as a separate chore. And you don't need security specialists to come along and do that part. You provide the code, they put it into their application. You might call this security as code, to implement in code the authentication policies, the multi-factor authentication, the strong authentication, the strong authorization policies, all available in code to be incorporated into the application. We're trying to make it as simple as possible to do this and as easy as possible, so that the developers don't have to think about it as a big burden. They just throw the code in at the beginning of the pipeline, do the security scans, show the results of the scans to the security architects, pass the reviews, and go to production. That's what we're trying to do to help this, because you're right, the developers don't think about it. Talking about the developer shortage earlier, that applies perhaps even more. We mentioned cloud is difficult. Security is even more difficult to find developers that know that. Our answer is, let's get that into the code, into the IDEs, into the pipeline, and make it as dead simple as possible.
Among the projects you've been working on, how many customers are looking at security, particularly when it comes to exposing backend data as part of the API?
That's a very important question. As Eric mentioned, security is part of those conversations. And this is a very important part, because API exposed data, and they need to have that particular layer in order to protect the data and the information from inside to outside.
Are people putting rate mechanisms in place? APIs work at the speed of the machine. If we're going to then have that level of interconnection, then any mistake means massive amounts of data can be lost very quickly. Is rate part of that conversation in terms of how data is accessed?
I can say absolutely it is. It's part of the API management policies that you can set. In our new products coming out early next year, we're going to have support for cloud native development, cloud native deployment on Kubernetes, cloud native security with Asguardio. Asguardio and Corio, our new API management plus-plus product, plus-plus being development and deployment with microservices and APIs. The combination of Corio and Asguardio should make it very easy to put in the security, set the rate limits, put in the monitoring, and all of the logging that you need to track and make sure that your applications are secure as you expect them to be. So you got the foundation to put it there, and then you have the tools and the observability, the monitoring and logging, the rate limiting, load balancing, all of this within the API management part to make sure it's happening as you'd want it to.
Normally at this point, I ask for three things that people can do to do things better. But I'm going to change that today. I'm going to start by asking for three pieces of bad behavior that you see that people have got to stop doing.
That's pretty easy. We talked about exposing APIs without refactoring them, without thinking about the customer, how they're going to be consumed. Because in the digital world, you have to think about things differently. It's not the employee you're building the applications for. It's the citizen, it's the customer who you don't have the ability to train. It has to be intuitive, easy to use out of the box. And many times companies will release websites and mobile apps that are just as bad as the employee apps in terms of usability. The second one is something else we touched on in terms of security. Often people expose the APIs without securing them. And when they're under attack, they're in a rear guard action. And it's really much more difficult to recover from a situation in which you put an insecure API out there than it is to take a few minutes and create that security to begin with. The third one we also touched on a bit during the conversation, which is taking your application as it's running on-prem and just moving it, lifting and shifting to the cloud and expecting to get all the benefits of the cloud. There's some investment to get those benefits. You need to put some time and effort into it. Sometimes people just think, oh, I'll get all the benefits of the cloud, I'll just move everything over, and I'll get the reliability, the scale, the resiliency, and so on. No, you have to change how you engineer the apps to get those things.
So having called out three things that they've got to stop doing, what are three things of best practice that will improve what they're doing?
Well, again, it's the API first. Ian, you've mentioned this many times, where you need to think about how the API is going to be used. One of the ways that I like to think about this and recommend it as a best practice, think about the service you are providing as a business to the customer. You're providing as a bank, a withdrawal service, deposit service, pay loan service. These are services bank provides to the customer. What you want to do is model these services as APIs that provide the same kind of service in software. Think about the service that you are providing as a government to the citizens, getting a driver's license or a passport or getting some kind of a benefit. That's the service the government's providing to them. Don't think about the IT system as being what supports the government employee. Think about it as supports that service the government's providing to the citizen and develop your API design based on that. That's a good way to improve how people think about API first. The second one, correlation of a worst thing not to do, make sure you put your API security design in place from the beginning. It's very much the same kind of thing as getting that GUI right. You have to get the design right. You have to get the interactions right. You have to get the security right at the beginning. If you're at the end of the day and you're putting something in production that doesn't have security, then you have to go all the way back to the beginning, start over again. So I'd say definitely start by putting the security in. That will help you quite a bit. The third thing we touched upon, try to think about the difference in moving to the cloud and the benefits you want to achieve and make a reasonable discussion. We see a lot of things in the press about, well, I tried microservices and it didn't work for me. What's all this hype about? Well, don't just assume microservice what you want to use. Understand the benefits of the investment in going to microservice from monolith and make your plan according to the trade-offs and the benefits, not just what's the latest trend. So the third thing to do is avoid doing things based on trends. Do the research, do the analysis, and figure out what's the best approach.
I think on that third one in particular, one of the challenges a lot of people have is new technologies coming at them faster and faster and faster. It's hard to find working examples that you can relate to your own business before you start to adopt a technology.
Oh, yes. We would have seen this at Citi, for example. We brought big data into the company with Hadoop to do some analysis. And management said, okay, you're going to use that for everything. And we're going, no, no. Sometimes a SQL database is the right answer, and sometimes big data is the right answer. You can't just take the latest trend and force fit it to everything. I think you're right, Ian, that this is what happens. People hear about a trend, they hear about microservices, and they think, okay, we've got to do everything that way. No, that's not true.
Evic and Ricardo, thank you for talking with me today.
Ian, my pleasure.
Thanks, Ian.